Welcome to the AdjunctNation.com podcast interview series. I'm P.D. Lesko, executive editor of Adjunct Advocate magazine, and today I'm speaking with Carrie Nelson, president of the American Association of University Professors. Carrie Nelson was born in 1946 and grew up in Philadelphia in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He received a B.A. from Antioch College in Ohio and a Ph.D. from the University of Rochester in New York. Since the fall of 1970, he has taught modern poetry and literary theory at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he is Jubilee Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences and Professor of English. As a member of the Modern Language Association's Delegate Assembly, he co-authored a number of reform proposals, including a major project to document salaries for contingent faculty in English and foreign languages. For 10 years, he served on the National Council of the American Association of University Professors. In 2006, Nelson was elected president of AAUP. He is running for re-election this year and spoke with me from his home in Urbana-Champaign.
The first question is, you describe yourself as a believer in street theater and the strategic uses of outrage, an unabashed liberal who never caught, quote, the politically correct bug. This isn't really true, though. You've been involved in the AAUP leadership roles for over a decade.
Oddly enough, I went from writing widely about higher education to being a council member. Most people sort of start lower than that and work in their local chapter, in their state conference, and gradually move up. But then there are people in the leadership like myself, Michael Berube, Adolph Reed, and some others, who've been active in higher education circles and then kind of make the leap to the AAUP when, you know, I or someone else thinks they would be good people to bring in. So that's, you know, although I've worked myself up in the national leadership, I didn't really start in the local and the state conference in that way. So I guess you'd characterize me as a kind of mixture of both.
And you've talked about the need to make change within the AAUP. If there are people who have been involved in the AAUP over long periods of time and get assimilated, you know, it sounds pejorative, but it's not meant to be pejorative. It's kind of assimilated like the Borg, you know? You become assimilated within an organization. How is it truly possible to enact substantive change?
Well, it depends upon, you know, what particular things you're focused on in terms of change. In the spring of 2006, as I was looking ahead to the possibility that I could win the election and become president, I began to ask myself, at that point as a vice president, as an executive committee member, what would have to happen for me to be able to run the organization? In other words, what changes would there have to be at that point for me to feel that I could even do my job in an adequate way? So I began putting those changes in place as best as I could as vice president. And part of what that meant was beginning to readjust the structural and power relationships between the elected leadership and the staff. The staff had also run the organization basically for 20 years. So I began getting the executive committee to pass some regulations basically for the elected leadership to begin to exercise the authority that it had always had, but that it had sort of failed to really use over the past 20 years.
One example that stood out to me was that you had the staff put together a list of email addresses that previously there had been no way to send out an email to the entire membership.
Right, and I think that at that point, every organization, you know, starting with the State Department and going down to the local Girl Scout troop, by that time had the email addresses, had lots of email addresses available.
Right.
We went from 8,000 accurate email addresses to 39,000 accurate email addresses in the course of a year. We send 2 emails a month to our members, and so we are able to update them on issues, and we're able to involve them in things. The staff office that over time was most unhappy with our inability to contact our members was government relations, because a bill would come up in Congress, and if you want people to write to their Congress people about legislation, you know, sometimes you have a few days to get the letters in there. We simply had no way to do that because we had no way of contacting our members except by mail. Every time you write to your members, it's over $40,000. Every time you email your members, you spend hardly anything at all. So it's really a huge difference. We also began a huge campaign to reach the faculty generally. Academe obviously goes to our members and to libraries, but it doesn't go much beyond that. So I also got the staff to collect non-member faculty emails, and by September we had about 350,000.
When you sent out your alerts, when the AAUP sent out its alerts to non-members, and if I heard you correctly, you sent out those alerts to the entire list of 350,000 faculty that you collected, that the staff collected?
Right, and then we'd send the same thing to our members, so
okay,
we were up pretty close to a total of 400,000 emails going out.
Okay, so you were sending out, or the AAUP was sending out, these alerts to non-members. Did the staff use those emails also to solicit people for membership?
My philosophy was, this is not, AAUP membership is not a situation where if you, like a highway, if you build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
I think, first of all, we really had to educate people about who we are and what we do. My initial impulse was not to invite anyone to be a member until the emails had gone on for a year to a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're really starting from very limited faculty awareness about issues like academic freedom and shared governance.
Well, shortly after you were elected, you were arrested. You came into your office like a lion, someone recently said to me. But over time, you've lost that momentum. Comments?
The statement on freedom in the classroom is, in part, a direct response and a tough response to right-wing attempts to curtail classroom freedom. And those attempts to curtail classroom freedom are particularly important for contingent faculty. That statement on freedom in the classroom was a tremendously urgent document, but we worked many months to craft it and revise it and fine-tune it, and I don't see that responding to the political climate of the United States as losing my sense of urgency and losing my sense of what's important.
It's not the same as being carted off by the police.
Well, when other opportunities for appropriate street theater arise, I'll be there.
Well, you talked a little bit about the use of part-time or contingent faculty. About 11% of the faculty represented by AAUP are non-tenured, about between 4,500 and 5,000 faculty. Over the last decade, that percentage has remained virtually the same, and this hasn't changed under your leadership in the past 2 years. Should AAUP represent part-time faculty at all, in your opinion?
Oh, absolutely. They are the faculty. I mean, it's that simple. If you're going to represent the faculty, then you have to represent part-timers. In practical terms, what we've been doing is asking those of our faculty unions, that is the unions that are affiliated with the AAUP, to take on the moral and professional responsibility to help part-timers on their campuses organize for collective bargaining. That's the first thing that the AAUP can do, which is to really make a difference in the lives of those part-timers at the institutions where we have local strength. And some of our locals have begun doing that. We have some that have done it, like University of Rhode Island, that has helped organize its part-timers. Because, as you know, part-timers often work at multiple schools. Their identities are often invisible to the faculty as a whole. They really present special challenges to organizing for collective bargaining. And I think a chapter where full-time faculty, tenured ladder faculty, are represented by collective bargaining really needs to reach out to its brothers and sisters in the contingent workforce and help them get representation. In the 20 or so years that I've been studying the problem of contingency and interviewing contingent faculty, nothing is more stark and nothing is more chilling than the difference between contingent faculty that have union representation and the difference between contingent faculty that do not. If you meet contingent faculty in the California Faculty Association, which I have for two decades, and it, you encounter people that have health care, retirement, investment in a retirement system, people who receive a salary increase every year. On the other hand, in especially on the East Coast, where I've met so many contingent faculty who have none of those things, the damage to their lives is really immense. So that, I think, is our first priority, and that is to actually affect the lives of contingent faculty on campuses where we have some power, and that's sort of what we've been focusing on. And I think gradually we'll get more contingent members, but, you know, we have to show what we can do for contingent faculty if we want them to sign on.
The AAUP's 2003 policy statement clearly suggests that part-time and contingent faculty have less to offer students than full-time tenure-track professors. And I'll read a little bit from it. It says, because of the time constraints imposed on contingent faculty, especially part-time faculty, teachers of undergraduate courses are less likely to be informed about the latest developments in an academic discipline and to be challenged by recent research and writing. Students of contingent faculty may have diminished opportunity to reach beyond the limits of the course outline and classroom to encounter a passion for scholarship. These are very clear words, and what they say is the AAUP believes very clearly that it's best to have a tenure-track faculty member in the classroom. And this is a question I have all the time, and that is, you have that belief. Leadership has that belief. Those are policy statements that you as a leader are expected to promulgate and support. How then can an organization do both things?
Well, I think historically, the AAUP for a long time took the position, perhaps more implicitly than explicitly, that the way to deal with the problem of contingency was to replace them with full-time tenure-track faculty.
Yes.
And for a long time, that's really what the AAUP argued should be the case. At some point, it became clear that widespread faculty participation in the SPACE program was perhaps more likely than turning most contingent positions into full-time positions.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think it took a long time for the AAUP to face reality on this issue. It's about 2 years ago, we did get some federal statistics for the first time that suggested that contingent faculty had about half the time that full-time faculty had to spend in classroom preparation, and about half the time that full-time faculty had to spend in areas like student advising. So the AUP is not wrong to think that contingent faculty are sometimes limited in the service that they can give by the circumstances of their life. I mean, as you know, people who teach at several different campuses and, you know, either operate as freeway flyers or as, you know, or as back road crawlers, just have a disrupted life that makes it a lot harder to sit down and talk to a student for an hour when it's in the faculty member's heart to do that. So it's realistic to say that, especially contingent lives that are highly stressed, and it is harder to keep up with your field if you're spending your time driving around teaching far too many courses. I meet people who teach 8 and 9 courses a semester in order to survive. When I came to the University of Illinois, I taught 3 courses a semester. That was the teaching load. And frankly, I could barely keep up. The most I could do was sort of, be a few hours ahead of my students. It took, especially if I taught 3 different courses and had 3 different preparations, I had no time to do anything else than struggle to keep up with the reading assignments and the grading and everything else. I don't know how I would have survived 8 courses or 9 courses a semester, and yet I know contingent faculty who do live that sort of life. And, there's a price. There's a price for higher education. Let me just say one more thing.
No one disagrees with that, but the question still remains. The AAUP is devoted to the protection and extension of tenure.
What I've always recommended is that the jobs of contingent faculty be protected, of individual contingent faculty be protected, and that the rate at which part-time jobs are converted to full-time jobs should never exceed the rate of voluntary withdrawal from contingent positions. That is voluntary attrition, not forced, but voluntary. Now, there are a whole series of additional problems that are at stake in contingency. The first of those is that when you have a majority of faculty on a campus who are contingent labor, the likelihood that faculty will have a significant role in shared governance dramatically diminishes. And
let me stop you for a moment.
Sure.
About 3 years ago, we did a piece on the participation of part-time faculty in governance at their institutions mm-hmm. in the Adjunct Advocate. And what we found consistently is that part-time faculty are not being thwarted by administrators from participating. They're being thwarted by their full-time faculty colleagues.
Without naming names, I'll say two things. One is that I have on more than one occasion encouraged contingent faculty to take over their AAUP chapters if they have the numbers to do it and put their issues front and center. They should have a lot more to say about what goes on than they presently do. And it is absolutely true that across the country, many tenured faculty fear the power of their contingent brothers and sisters. And that fear, I think, is fundamentally irrational because it doesn't recognize the structural effects of contingency and the way that the denial of shared governance rights to a majority of the teaching force means that shared governance in itself, in the end, is eviscerated. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous educational project that needs to take place to get full-time faculty, those of them to whom one can still reach, which is certainly not 100%, since many of them have their heads in the sand, to recognize that we are, in fact, all in one boat. The tenure-track faculty are not inherently, and contingent faculty are not inherently enemies of one another. They need to find ways of finding common cause. And, you know, I'm planning this fall to issue some statements trying to articulate the ways in which contingent faculty and full-time faculty, in fact, can find common cause, because I think we need to unite the professoriate under one banner.
You've been listening to part one of a two-part interview series with Dr. Kerry Nelson, president of the American Association of University Professors. I'm P.D. Lesko, and this is the AdjunctNation.com podcast interview series.